Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 3 minutes after 9 a.m. Thursday, March 10th, 2011. With me today is Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire. Our other colleagues will be joining us lately. There's budget subcommittees going on. Myself, Senator Stedman. Up today, we have two items on the agenda. Senate Bill 34, Small Business Revolving Loan Fund. Senate Bill 58, Increasing Number of Superior Court Judges. And we're going to start today with the first bill up, Senate Bill 34 by Senator Wilikowski regarding Small Business Revolving Loan Fund. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. And with us today, I see Senator Wilikowski. If you can come forward, please. And if Senator Wilikowski, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, Bill Wilikowski, I'm State Senator for Northeast Anchorage, and with me today is my Chief of Staff, Michelle Seideman. The governor had a similar bill to this last year, and it didn't pass. As I was out this past year, last year, speaking with constituents, I ran into a number who supported this bill, small business people who thought this was a good idea. And so I asked my staffer, Michelle, if she would look into it and see whether the governor had an intent to refile it. Didn't get any response back. So, and it was multiple contacts that were made. So we went ahead and spoke with a number of our colleagues, including Senator Ellison, Senator McGuire, and Senator Thomas, and others. And we decided to file this as a bipartisan piece of legislation from the Senate, saying that we supported this bill, thought it was a good idea. I've spoken with small business people in my community who have told me that they've had problems accessing credit. I think you may be hearing from one today. I think part of the problem is banks are reluctant to lend to startup firms, small businesses that don't have an established track record. And I think you'll hear some testimony of that this morning. The governor does have a bill which does include this and some other things, and the Labor and Commerce Committee, in their wisdom, decoupled, if you will, that this bill from the other portions of the bill. So I'll stop right there, Mr. Chairman, and have my staffer, Michelle, walk you through the bill. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Michelle Seideman, and I serve as staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. As Senator Wilikowski mentioned, there are six co-prime sponsors of this bill from both parties, three of whom are represented on the committee today. The purpose of SB 34 is to promote economic development throughout the state by ensuring that all our small businesses have access to the capital they need. Nationally, as I'm sure you all know, the number of businesses who report having access to adequate capital has declined significantly in the past several years. In 2008, 78% reported that they did have access to the capital they needed. This has declined to 62% in 2009 and 59% in 2010. And these statistics are brought to us by the National Small Business Association, which conducts a twice-yearly survey of many, many small businesses. As you'd imagine, we've also seen fewer loans issued in the past several years. From 2008 to 2009, the number of new small business loans fell 33% to its lowest level in a decade. And what we're hearing now from small businesses is that their use of all types of financing mechanisms, from credit cards to traditional bank loans to vendor loans, has all decreased significantly. The latest statistic I saw is that now 4 out of 5 businesses report that they have been affected by the credit crunch. And these are national numbers. So why is this a problem? Well, one of the most important reasons is that small businesses tend to drive job growth. According to Ben Bernanke, small businesses employ roughly half of all American workers, and they account for about 60% of job creation. One interesting fact is that businesses less than 2 years old are especially critical in this regard. Over the past 20 years, startups have accounted for roughly 25% of job creation, so their access to capital is particularly critical. I've spoken with several economists in state to ask them whether our situation in Alaska is any different. They all stress to me that no, access to capital for our small businesses is as important here as it is in the lower 48, and in fact it may even be more so because of the high cost of doing businesses up here and many of the other challenges that you're aware of. So given this general landscape, the sponsors of this bill thought it was important that we listen to the advice of Fed Chairman Bernanke. And he recently made a statement that making credit accessible to sound small businesses is crucial to the nation's economic recovery and should be front and center among the nation's policy challenges. Of course, one answer, one way to do this is through creation of a small business revolving loan fund, which is exactly what this bill proposes. Nationally, these funds that lend small amounts are known as microloan programs. There are 46 states across the country that implement a program designed by the Federal Small Business Administration. There are two additional states that are able to access this federal program through neighboring states, and that only leaves two states essentially out in the cold. Alaska is one of those two states that does not have a microloan program already. The reason for this is that so far no private lenders have come forward and stated their willingness to serve as an intermediary lender, and there's lots of paperwork that goes into establishing yourself as an intermediary lender, but the effect of that is that there's no microloan program in the state of Alaska, so we're just one of two states in that position. As Senator Wilikowski mentioned, last year the governor wisely introduced HB 412 to create such a program. The bill did pass unanimously in the House, but it came over to the Senate very late in the session, and we were not able to pass it. Over the interim, we did call the Department of Commerce on several different occasions to determine whether they plan to reintroduce the bill, and that wasn't information they were able to provide us. So as the senator said, we did go ahead, got a group of six senators together, and introduced this bill. So this bill differs in maybe three key respects from the governor's bill. One is that during the interim, when we talked to small businesses, one of their recommendations was that we consider slightly increasing the maximum loan limit from what the governor had in his bill last year. That limit was $70,000, and it continues to be that in the coupled bill that Senator Wilikowski mentioned earlier. This bill does raise that limit up to $100,000, and I'll talk about that more later. The other thing we did is we've tried to work closely with bankers in Alaska. One of the things that they asked for is a turn-down provision, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. This provision requires that anyone seeking a loan in excess of $35,000 prove that they have gone to a local banking institution and been turned down before they approach the state for a loan in excess of that amount. This bill also differs in that we require applicants to provide a minimum of a 20% match for any state dollars they're requesting. Applicants for this program must, of course, be Alaska residents, and their business must be located in the state, and they must provide sufficient collateral to secure the loan. And I wanted to add a note that nationally, microloans have a very, very low default rate. It's less than 5%. And the Department of Commerce expects an even lower default rate in Alaska. Their current rate of default is less than 1%. So we have a good track record up here, or they have a good track record. Loans would bear an interest rate of the prime plus one with a floor of 6% and a cap of 8%. And the maximum loan term would be 6 years. As I mentioned earlier, loans requested by one individual could not exceed $50,000, and for a partnership involving two or more people, it could go up to just $100,000, and the program would be housed within the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, where they have, I believe, something like 12 other loan programs.
You say a variation of 6 to 8%. What criteria would you use to determine the 6% versus the 8%?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that is a good question. I hope you will ask that of Director Juanita Ayers, because I know that their loan officers look at the business plan of anyone requesting a loan, perhaps at the type of collateral, and I'm not sure how they make that determination. This is a recommendation we took from their bill, and we trusted that they did the math on it, but I think it's worth exploring.
Page 4, line 9,
yeah,
8 and 9, talk about the interest rate being prime plus 1, minimum of 6%. Is that not the issue in it?
Senator Stedman, yes, that is the appropriate section. And I believe Senator Hoffman's question was about how do you determine, and maybe the answer is simply that it would depend on where the prime is in part. If the prime were down under, you know, at 3.5%, then you would just go to the floor. And if it were up above 8%, you'd go to the ceiling.
We'll clarify that a little later.
This program does complement two other programs that the Department of Commerce runs. One is the Small Business Economic Development Revolving Loan Fund, and another is the Rural Development Initiative Fund. Wanted to take a moment to just describe those two funds and how this program would differ from them. The Economic Development Fund relies on funding from the federal EDA, and it's targeted exclusively at communities experiencing economic hardship. Funds are also used primarily for long-term financing, and there are many federal requirements that must be met. The Rural Development Fund, unlike the prior fund, was created with state funds. Again, however, it's primarily for long-term financing, and this fund is also only available in communities of 5,000 people or less if connected to the rail belt, or communities of less than 2,000 if connected. So again, there are geographic requirements that must be met to apply for either of those two funds. In contrast, this fund would provide short-term loans, short-term low-interest loans, to Alaskan businesses throughout the state, and these funds could be used for working capital, buying inventory, making payroll, equipment, and leasehold improvements.
Document was hidden right where it's supposed to be. Go ahead and continue.
Again, I wanted to emphasize that loans would be available in all regions of the state, and there would be a simple and streamlined application process, $100 to apply and a 1% loan origination fee.
But in our packet, there's a table that has quite a few of the loans that are available with some information on them. So I think we need to talk about that issue, but go ahead.
As the sponsors have envisioned this bill, it would be capitalized with $3.5 million. Of course, all earnings and loan repayments would be retained by the fund for future loans, and operating expenses would come from the fund itself. There are two potential fund sources, one of which is much more likely. That would be general funds, but the Congress did create a new loan fund last year. It's called the State Small Business Credit Initiative that U.S. Treasury is administering. It was created through the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010, and $1.5 billion has been appropriated to strengthening state programs that support lending to small businesses. It's a formula-driven program. Our share is roughly $13 million. The state administration has filed a letter of intent to apply for these funds, and the deadline is fast approaching. We did hear, however, in the past several weeks, even this week, there's been further clarification, and this fund may not qualify for those dollars. So, of course, the fiscal note does reflect $35 million general fund capitalization. The department has run several cash flow analyses. I believe Director Ayers can speak to those. When we were putting this bill together, they told us that probably there'd be 20 loans issued in the first year with an average amount of $35,000 and 25 in all succeeding years. By 2017, all the principal would be pushed out of the fund, but of course the fund would be making earnings and monies would continue to be relent. So we've gotten tremendous support from around the states for this concept of a microloan program from business groups and individual businesses. Robin Samuelson from the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation points out that traditional sources of capital are simply not available in his region. They're not viable sources for many small entrepreneurs. Bill Popp with the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation commented that this type of modest investment by the state could yield significant benefits and lead to the employment of many more Alaskans. Debbie Fowler with the Alaska Small Business Development Center pointed out that many small businesses do not find lending options with banks due to the small amount of their loan request. And just in the past couple of days, I've heard of somebody that was seeking a loan of just $2,000 and was having difficulty finding a bank that was interested because that's just such a small amount. From Swampsea, Andy Varner at Swampsea, we heard suggestions for the type of individuals that might be interested in such a fund. He points to small business owners, small fish processors, bed and breakfast owners, those who want to start daycare centers, and mechanics. So clearly in rural areas of the state in particular, where they really are micro businesses, this micro loan program would be very beneficial. We also heard from a small business owner who says that this, during this period of credit crunch, his access to capital has really dried up. He's traditionally relied on loans to get him through slow times to buy inventory and make payroll, and he's no longer able to do that. So as I mentioned earlier, one of our great pleasures during the course of the last committee was to work closely with the Alaska Bankers Association to address their concerns and to come out of that process with a letter of endorsement from them. And one of the things that they have emphasized is that they do seek to make loans, you know, under $100,000. They do try to provide those loans, but the anecdotal comments we're receiving is that some of the smaller loans, really it's hard to find a private lender in Alaska that's willing to make those loans. In closing, just want to say that nationally these are very, very small loans. The national average is something in the range of $12,000 to $13,000. This program would only be available to Alaska residents. The payback period is a quick one, 6 years or less. And for many small businesses, this is the difference or could make the difference between success and failure, particularly in a time when when credit's tight for small businesses. And the program would be self-sustaining, including the operating costs. So that concludes our overview.
Can you stack these loans?
Senator Stedman, I don't know the answer to that question, and we'll defer that to Director Ayers.
And then earlier you had mentioned that I think we're the only state that doesn't come under the federal microloan program. Can you elaborate on that a little bit again?
Chair Stedman, my understanding is that there are actually 46 states that have programs under the SBA guidelines. There are two other states that are able to access programs run by neighboring states, and then there are just two states, and we're one of those two, and I should have done research and found out who the other state is, but I can't even answer that question. So there are two states without existing microloan programs.
And then the response from the industry of why they don't participate is what they felt it was burdensome. Regulatory-wise, or how? Why aren't we involved?
Yes. Senator Stedman, that's a question I have asked. And I think I'd prefer if Juanetta Ayers answered that question. I'm not sure that I can speak for the banks on that.
And then just as a reminder, if you're here to testify on this bill, you need to sign up, if you're from an agency, on the sign-up sheet so I know who's in the audience. Right now I've got nobody signed up on this bill. So, and I've got one person that we'll get to in the public hearing that's called in, but if you're in the room, you need to put your name on the list so when we have questions, we know who to ask to come forward. And then the bank, just for clarifications, you don't have to have a denial letter from the bank or lending institution unless the amount is over $35,000 and the loan cap is $100,000. Is that correct?
Senator Stedman, that's correct. And that is one additional difference with the governor's bill. The governor's bill, you can borrow up to $70,000. And there's no turn down provision required at all. Our bill, we do put that provision in after $35,000.
I don't think we're too interested in a bill that was in the last session. So just to help me clarify it, so it's $35,000, you have to have a document showing that you were declined at a lending institution. Below $35,000, what's the minimum of the loan? And I assume the 20% down payment or participation is 20% regardless of the loan amount.
Senator Stedman, I didn't hear the final words. It's 20% regardless of
loan amount.
Senator Stedman, yes, the 20% is a minimum amount. The department can require more than that. That's a matter that they work out. They work very closely with their loan requesters, so they could require, in fact, more than that. And there is no minimum loan amount written into the bill. That's something that you could consider adding.
Okay. We have seen no other questions. We've got initial questions from the committee. We have a first fiscal note is a fund transfer of $3.5 million in general funds to capitalize the loan fund. The second fiscal note is for $85,300 to cover the cost of one new position to administer the loan fund. This expense will be paid from the earnings of the fund. And with that, we'll go on to public testimony. We've got several people here signed up, six or seven, just to give the committee members an idea of the amount of folks online. We're going to start with Matt Sue. What I'd like you to do is introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please, the bill 34. And we'll start with Mike Orbford. Mike Orbford, please.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you for this time. My name is Mike Orbford. I'm the Executive Director of the Maiden Matsu Association, and I'm here today to represent our members, our affiliates, and our vendors. The bill 34, in the view of our members, Senate Bill 34 is of utmost importance today in this credit crunch here in our area. We have many members that have come to us saying they cannot, they're looking to expand their businesses. And Senate Bill 34 would offer an added opportunity for them to get funding to accomplish that. I wanted to give you one example very briefly about one of our members. Her company is ready to double and triple in size very quickly, and unfortunately, because he's never had to obtain credit in the past, owns her home outright, she can't get credit. She even went in for a loan as small as $2,000 and was denied and was told, you don't have bad credit, just have no credit. Yeah. We think this bill is probably the perfect venue for a business exactly like hers. We'd like to lend our full support, and we hope that all of the members of the Senate Finance Committee do support Alaska small business through the implementation of this bill. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. We're now going to go to the off-net. I'm just going to go down to the list as they're given. And again, identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill. Brookie McLaughlin.
Hello, good morning. My name is Brooke McLaughlin, and I represent Krabby Sisters. And I am a co-owner with Megan Clark. We're two female business owners here in Anchorage. I reside in Kodiak and operate out of Anchorage. Krabby Sisters is a food company based out of Anchorage. Currently, we manufacture only one product, and that is our gluten-free Alaskan King crab cakes. We've incorporated our business in 2009 and have worked extensively with the UAF, Kodiak Campus Expertise Center, as well as Small Business Development Center in Anchorage. We've participated in over 40 hours of group training seminars and additionally meet with our business advisors, specifically focusing on development of our company's financial analysis and future projections. It is with our sound decision-making that we have obtained phenomenal resources and have successfully navigated our way to local, to the local marketplace. Our product has just been pieces, and we were based on taste, packaging, and commercial market potential. Our market development has provided production numbers, and they are just demonstrating a high consumer and commercial demand for our product. And this demand means growth, and growth means expansion. In order for us to manufacture locally, and in order to achieve this, we will need a loan to meet our cash flow needs. Unfortunately, it has been an experience that despite our ability to demonstrate good character, capacity to repay, favorable market conditions, and previous small business experience, we are categorized as a startup business, and we are a huge red flag to the financial institutions. We believe we're a candidate, a qualified candidate for this microloan program, and this bill would assist in breaking down this barrier for our expansion and growth, and provide it at a healthy, steady pace. Please support this bill. It will do a number of things. It'll keep manufacturers here in Alaska instead of taking our needs elsewhere. We will continue to provide growth in employment and make a difference in our state and, you know, provide a product that's locally made and produced here for the rest of the U.S. And if there's anything else, please give us a call.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. We're going now to Chris Schutte, please. Chris Schutte.
Good morning. My name is Chris Schutte. I'm the executive director for Anchorage Downtown Partnership here in Anchorage. Anchorage Downtown Partnership is an organization that represents over 900 business and property owners in downtown Anchorage. Our mission is to increase the occupancy rates, the investment values, to decrease crime, and to stimulate economic development here in downtown. We are extremely supportive of SB 34. A small business revolving loan fund or microloan fund is precisely what many of our stakeholders have been searching for over the past few years. Despite the state of the national economy, the Anchorage economy has fared quite well, and many of our member businesses actually experienced growth in demand for their goods or services, a growth that many of them were unable to meet because they lacked the capital to ramp up their operations. Examples among our stakeholders include an architecture firm whose business rapidly grew during the past few years as federal, state, and local capital projects came to fruition, and a hotel owner who was poised to renovate and upgrade his small hotel to meet a growing demand for what's known as boutique hotels. In both cases, these businesses were ready to grow to meet the demands for their particular service or product, but in both cases were unable to secure capital that they needed to expand. Creating this microloan fund through the DCCED will benefit Alaska small businesses tremendously, including many of our stakeholders. Providing faster access to small amounts of capital for growing or expanding businesses that have been unable to secure loans through traditional means is precisely what small businesses need. I want to thank Senator Wilikowski and the rest of this committee for discussing this issue, and we would encourage the committee to support SB 34.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and it's nice to hear from representation of downtown Anchorage about the economic impact that this committee was involved in keeping the worldwide recession from hitting Anchorage. But it's nice to actually hear positive comments, because in this line of work, normally you hear from the other side. We'll now go on to Eric O'Brien. Eric O'Brien, please.
This opportunity. My name is Eric O'Brien, representing Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference. During the height of the economic crisis, Ben Bernanke pointed out that the heart of the problem was a lack of liquidity and cash, and the most important thing to do was to pump more capital into the economy, to the point where you could dump bags of cash out of a helicopter. Well, the microloan program is a much more refined means of injecting that cash into local economies, allowed you to set benchmarks and objectives. So similarly, like problems that this country faces, is problems that are facing rural Alaska, and that there is a lack of capital and liquidity. But especially with Southwest Alaska, we're special in that while there's poor regions and locales, there's also a great deal of wealth, resource, and opportunity. And if fishermen, processors, lodge, or any other number of small entrepreneurs can find access to that capital, they might be able to promote growth and especially bridge the downtimes, often in slow fishing seasons or in an economic crunch, the slow of tourism to the region. I offer a dual perspective. Working with Swampsea, I have a high-level view, economic development from a broad perspective. But I also grew up in the village of Larson Bay, so I feel like I've got a local perspective. In the village life, and I imagine much rural Alaska, there's just a lack of resources. But again, they have so much potential with all the natural resources, and especially with the fishing and tourism opportunities, of funds flowing towards the community, that there's a lot of opportunity for creative entrepreneurs. So I have this story about this man named Carl from the village of Larson Bay. He had a plan to take people he was transporting people from the village to the river, the Karluk River. The other opportunity was for clients, tourists, to fly out on a float plane, which is expensive, and there's many people that can afford that. But there's also a weather problem, and when the weather comes in, there's been times when people have got stuck out there, and this is a concern for the lodges. So this local man, Carl, had a business plan in place where he was going to get a fleet of four-wheelers and ferry people back and forth when either the weather was bad and it was just dangerous to fly, or maybe is to compete with the high-value float plane operation. I don't think that Carl ever did get his business off. I know Carl did not get his business off the ground, but thinking of him and that creative entrepreneur, this would be a perfect opportunity to help facilitate the business creation and another job growth and wealth in that community. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
We'll go on now to Tracy LaBarge. Tracy LaBarge. still on?
She's on. She may be away from the phone.
Okay, we'll go on to Jason Hoke. Jason Hoke.
God damn it.
Yes, Senator, my name is Jason Hoke. I'm the Executive Director for Copper Valley Development Association here in Glen Ellen, an area about the size of the state of Ohio, and we are the state arter for this area, facilitating economic growth and natural resource development. I'd like to support SB 34, as we have many small businesses out here in the forest industry, tourism industry, agriculture. Many of them are small cottage industries. This bill would allow for greater growth as well as for the startup of other businesses in this area. I don't think a week goes by where I don't have somebody coming in looking to start up a business in the tourism industry or in the agricultural industry, and they just can't find the funding to get it off the ground or even to expand an existing business. I really hope and urge you, Senators, to please support SB 34, because I think it's just what's needed for an area such as this.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, thank you.
Going now to Carl Berger. Carl Berger.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Carl Berger, and I'm the Executive Director for the Lower Kuskokwim Economic Development Council, based in Bethel, and providing services to approximately 40 villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Our problem, our region, is lack of access to capital. Despite the fact that we have two banks and a credit union in Bethel, there is not sufficient access for people, particularly those who have no credit history. It's very difficult to approach a bank when you don't have any history to be able to get assistance. And I think this bill, Senate Bill 34, would be ideal for the needs that we have in our region for people who are interested in being entrepreneurs and starting small businesses and advancing their ideas. I see the bill has bipartisan support, and I'm glad to see that. And I'm sure that Senator Hoffman is very much in support of this bill because it would aid many people in our region who have business ideas and would like to act on them. I have worked in western and northern Alaska for almost 50 years now, and I feel like I've seen a lot of opportunities go by that people who were local could have taken advantage of had they had the ability to be able to get a loan. And I think this program would go a long way to help the local people in our Alaskan communities. And after all, that's what the legislature is here to do, is to spend resources on the people of Alaska. So I'm very much in support of this bill, and thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Carl, for calling in today. We're going to back up and see if we can't pick up Tracy LaBarge. Is she still on?
Yes, she's on.
Tracy LaBarge, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call back. I applaud this bill for coming back into committee and also for raising the amount of this bill. I am a small business owner going on my sixth year of business, and I deal with the crab fishery, which is a commodity, and the prices fluctuate greatly. It is very important. I was happy to hear Brooke call in, because this is exactly the type of business that this type of loan can benefit. Had I had access to this type of loan in the beginning, I would have been able to retain, you know, more than 60% of my sales. Whereas because of crab prices increasing, I've had to put that money back into, you know, just kind of playing catch up on the treadmill. So I think it's very important to be able to have this type of lending available. I have a home that I put up originally as collateral. Because of the market, that home isn't worth as much as it used to be. I've never been able to receive more than 20% funding since I started. So my money has never increased that I could, from the banks. I use pretty much credit cards and loans from friends to keep going. I have been able to receive, you know, a JDC loan that has helped me stay in business, but every year it is a struggle to come up with more funding, even though my business doubles every year And I've proven over and over that I can pay these loans back. It's very important to keep Alaskans, in business. And when you're dealing with the fisheries and the commodity, like we have here, it's important to have something like this to fall back on. Thank you again for bringing this bill back to committee, and I hope this bill passes. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our off-net list, and we have nobody signed up in the room, but we do have a participant from Division of Economic Development. If she can come forward, please. You can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Winnetta Ayers, and I'm the director for the Division of Economic Development.
Ayers, could you help us a little bit with the bill in front of us? And maybe explain to the committee how it would work. Somebody, for instance, out in the lower Kuskokwim or down in southeast, I assume somebody's assume this position will be in Juneau or possibly Anchorage, and how they would go about getting a loan and how you'd know that they were legit.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. That's a multifaceted question. I'll try and tease out sort of the pieces of it. First of all, with regard to how the loan application process would work and where the position would be located, a number of our loan application processes are online. And so people across the state have access to apply to a loan fund through the state website. We also have people, of course, who walk into locations here in Juneau and in Anchorage. If this is a successful process and it goes forward, we would monitor the loan demand to determine where the position should be located. I think that the bulk of our staff is located here in Juneau. That makes sense from a number of respects, but we also do have the possibility of staffing this position in Anchorage. So we would want to make that recommendation based on where the loan demand was coming from. About 84% of the loan funds that we lend out now are outside of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And of course, we have a significant amount of demand here in the southeast region, also in the western and southwest areas. And that speaks well to the fact that what I do want to say about the banking community is that we're very fortunate to have a stable banking community in Alaska, and they do want to compete for the opportunity to they want to compete for the business firms to participate in these loans with small business, and we're very comfortable with that idea that we're the lender of last resort in this circumstance. And so I would say that the banks coming out of the economic circumstances of the last couple of years have more stringent requirements on them, and it makes the notion of a microloan fund and the availability of it, I think, even more vital for business startup and business growth in Alaska and across the nation.
Let me try to rephrase that question, I guess. Okay. Help me a little bit on the, especially the smaller ones, less than $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is most business loans or most loans to small businesses are for inventory and related items, trying to control their or manage their cash flow, mm-hmm. and keep their product line full. So if I was the fellow sitting in Sitka and I wanted $30,000 to mm-hmm. for my inventory, how would you know I was even legit and I had the 20% down payment in cash laying around and that I wasn't just trying to get $30,000 to go to Vegas and have some fun?
Thank you for that question. We have, with regard to our lending practices, and all of the borrowers under this microloan fund would be required to show collateral. And if you look at our lending practices with regard to the other loan funds, the experience level that we have with our loan programs and the performance of those, that our practices with regard to proving up collateral and proving up the viability of borrowers has been very good with our low delinquency rates, our low foreclosure rates. Thank you. And we require a great degree of documentation. That's part of our process as with any other lender. So I guess through that process of working with the borrower to determine what their capacity is, someone may come in and seek funds for at a certain level. We may have to work with them to right-size what their request is according to their capacity.
So then the collateral would be inventory you'd hold in collateral generally, or would you want to hold other things in collateral? And would it be 100% collateral or 200% or a recourse or non-recourse loan, or what are we doing?
I think that in general, we've had pretty stringent collateral requirements, in some cases exceeding the loan amount by 2-to-1. Again, we have borrowers throughout rural Alaska that access to capital and secure means of exchange are an issue. We've worked, for example, with the fishing community on loans over the life of very dire circumstances in the fishing industry to work with borrowers to determine what their capacity is and determine the right scope for a particular loan. With the case of inventory, I'd have to go back and look at that specific circumstance. I'm more familiar when we have hard assets like boats or other real property to determine the capacity of the borrower.
Right, because I would expect there's a little difference here than the fishing loans. I would expect that most of the loan requirement here would be for inventory issues and small business loans. And are these going to be recourse or non-recourse loans?
Senator Sullivan, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I'd have to get back to you on that.
John, you understand the question, correct?
I don't understand the question. I apologize.
Recourse loan is they go after you for anything you own to collect the debt. Mm-hmm. Non-recourse, they can only go after the collateral wherever you put up, and they can't go after everything else.
Right.
Normally, the banks seem to like the recourse loans where you put everything, including your first child, up.
Well, without addressing the specific nature of the question, Chairman, I can say that in discussions about this, we've discussed what the nature of, like, for example, we have had to foreclose on loans and go after assets of individuals and businesses that have defaulted on loans in the past. But we have a very good history within the division of recovery and
Well, maybe you can get back to the committee on the recourse non-recourse
sure.
question
mm-hmm.
concerning this
sure.
particular
mm-hmm.
Proposed mm-hmm. statute, which is a little different than some of the other loans.
It is. Yes.
We have other questions for the department, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, on page 4, line 11, continuing on a bit with the collateral, it says must be secured by collateral acceptable to the commissioner. I'm sure it's not quite that arbitrary or subjective. Is there something you could get to us that gives the general language of what is acceptable or not? Not necessarily right at this moment, but just for our consideration so that we don't think it's quite that arbitrary that the commissioner decides it. We don't want people thinking that. We just decide based on whatever their own criteria might be in relationship to that particular individual's ability to do business, and it almost appears we have language that says that, so, in the bill.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I can get you some more specific information with regard to the kinds of small business loans and the practices that we've had in the past. If that would answer your question, I think your question indicates that there it might be a case-by-case circumstance. Is that the nature of your question?
Yes, that's the nature of the question, but if there is not a list of things, you would think that when someone applied, they're given, you know, some kind of indication of what is acceptable collateral, and that would be helpful for us to know rather than it seeming so subjective. And one other minor question, if I may. On this sheet that we have, the number or the percent of delinquencies and foreclosures are extremely low, and at least my assessment of it related to sponsored loans by the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. Is that generally the case? Is this typical, these numbers, when we get away from sponsored loans like that amongst and take into consideration banks and other financial institutions? Are those generally typical of small business loans, foreclosure and delinquency rates?
With regard to the entire portfolio, if you're looking at all of the loan funds, our delinquency rate is less than 1%, and that it varies by loan fund. It can, for example, I believe the SBED loans are currently the highest. That's a complicated loan fund to manage because it is federal funds. It has certain requirements. It is targeted specifically to areas in economic distress. And it has multiple management plans. Right now we're working with the EDA to standardize that under one management plan so that it can be managed in a more streamlined fashion and hopefully make it funding more available. There's some difficulty with managing the fund with multiple streams of requirements and then having loan demand come in and trying to apply it to the right circumstance under that particular loan fund. But that one is the one that has the highest individual delinquency rate right now. The
question is more specifically is, are the loans that the state makes delinquency rates typical of what you would see in the general industry of financial? Are we above or below?
Through the chairman, thank you for that question, Senator Thomas. It's significantly below what the national standards are. I don't have a number off the top of my head, but we have an excellent lending staff, and they work very well with borrowers and understand the circumstances of borrowers in Alaska to work through their particular issues, right-size loans to them, and work through them with them if they get into circumstances where we need to understand their particular situation and work out modifications for them.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for agency or bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none. We have, I've had some discussions with Co-Chair Hoffman concerning the multitude of loans and other financial assistance packages we have throughout the state. And was it roughly 20 years ago or sometime, they had a document prepared, a booklet as a handout, so people could easily go to one document and see what's available around the state. And we're in the process of trying to upgrade that. That publication and get it out. Also looking through it to see what items within there we should look at closing down, getting off the statutes. Mm-hmm. So as we set this bill aside and go forward, I think one of the things that stand out is in our sheet here is we have got two, I guess there's one mining loan out, two in the historical districts, zero in alcohol. So there's some areas that we need to take a look at as a committee and possibly do a little cleanup if we decide to move this bill forward. On the whole discussion, it would fit in with what Co-Chair Hoffman and myself have been having some dialogue on. Mm-hmm. We have any final comments from the bill sponsor?
Senator Stedman, I did just want to say that Senator Wilikowski regretted that he had to leave to go chair the State Affairs Committee, so he wanted me to pass that along.
Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Go on to our next item on the agenda, which is Senate Bill 58. Senate Bill 58 is sponsored by the Rules Committee at the request of the court system and would increase the number of Superior Court judges. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the bill sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. And we are going to invite Mr. Liver to come forward. And introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then what we have in front of us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. The Alaska Supreme Court, through House Senate Bill 58, is asking for two new Superior Court judges in Anchorage, and those judges would preside over civil cases. Additional judges are needed for a few reasons, in part because Anchorage has, by a significant margin, the highest caseload of any other Superior Court location in Alaska. Anchorage judges handle 687 cases per judge last year. The next busiest court is here in Juneau that handled 570 cases. Not only is the caseload high in Anchorage, but there's two particular types of cases that have resulted in a significant change in how those cases, or we handle those cases differently, and those changes have led to a significant increase in the workload. The first of those are child need of aid cases, and you may recall child need of aid cases are cases where the state has taken custody of children for the protection of those children. The prior practice in Anchorage was to have standing masters hear most of the work associated with those cases. Standing masters are they're like assistants to a Superior Court judge. They sit behind a bench. They wear a robe. They're subject matter experts. But they make recommendations to a Superior Court judge. They're not judges themselves. Our prior practice was to have the standing masters preside over those cases until there was a contested issue, at which point it would be transferred to a Superior Court judge who would resolve the contested issue, and then the case would be transferred back again to the standing master who would proceed until there's another contested issue. And as you know, some of these child need of aid cases can be around for a significant period of time. Having standing masters preside over an awful lot of these proceedings did save Superior Court judge time, but it led to other problems. Not only were the families shuffled back and forth between the Superior Court judge and the standing master, given whatever the nature of their hearing was, but it also left the Superior Court judge, who is the one with the final authority in those cases, with little familiarity with the families. They would only sit on some of those hearings. Our current practice, which the members of the China Bar I think is a much better practice, judges like it, families like it, is the case starts the same as before. A child need of aid case will go to a standing master until there is a contested issue. But at that point, the case permanently transfers to the Superior Court judge, and that judge will then preside over all the hearings for the life of that case, which can be lengthy. This process not only gets rid of the shuffling back and forth problem, but it also results in the judge with the final decision-making authority knowing the family a whole lot better. As social workers and attorneys who work in these areas know, the better you get to know the family, the more trust develops, and the judge simply learns more than he or she would have if they'd only handled cases intermittently. But, again, it takes more time to do this. We think it's a better model, but it's a more time-consuming model for the Superior Court judges. Another important change we've made in our child need of aid practice is we have a lot more status hearings than we used to have. When a family comes into the child need of aid system, they will work with the agencies and the court, and they will come up with what is frequently a laundry list of things they need to do to get their lives in order so that they can get their children back. Frequently, they'll have to attend maybe anger management classes, substance abuse treatment. They may need to find a job. They may need to get the abusive partner out of the household that's a threat to the children. Sometimes the list of things they need to do is nearly overwhelming. One of the things that the judges have started doing to help families get through this process better is to have a lot of status hearings. The prior practice was that you would have a hearing with the judge, and you will come back in several months and find out whether or not you've worked through all of your issues, worked with the agencies. But the current practice is to have a lot of status hearings, and this is something that we've picked up through the therapeutic courts, that if you have people appear before judges on a regular basis, you keep them focused and on track, and you're much likely to get the results you want. As all of you know, perhaps more than most, a lot of activity is deadline-driven. Things around here get much, much busier close to adjournment time. Well, litigants are also deadline-driven, and one thing that motivates behavior for a litigant is that you're going to have a court hearing not in 6 months but in 2 weeks. And the judge will kind of set a timeline. He'll say, you know, and okay, we're going to see you in 2 weeks. I want to see what you've done about finding a safe place to live. And next, we're going to see about that substance abuse treatment. Regular hearings before the judge, we think, significantly increases the likelihood that the parents will be successful. The child in need of aid statutes that the legislature has adopted strongly encourage family reunification. That's the goal, a safe child back with their home. We think this process is going to result in better outcomes, more likely success for the parents. But again, all these status hearings, although they better serve the families, they take more judicial time. The other case type that has changed in nature over the years are a lot of our family law cases. And the big change here is the increase in unrepresented litigants, people coming to court without attorneys. As you know, for centuries, the court systems have been dominated by attorneys. And although that's still very much the case, there are some case types where society is just no longer tolerating that. And one of those is family law cases. We don't have historical data going back very far on the percentage of people who come to court without attorneys, but we do have fairly recent data once we've started gathering it. And it's consistent with what we've seen, what judges all across the country have seen, which is a dramatic increase in people showing up without lawyers. Right now in family law cases, when first filed, about 33% of our cases have an attorney on both sides. About 29% have an attorney on just one side, and 38% have no attorneys at all. And the percentage of cases without attorneys increases as the process moves along. If you're at the stage of your case where you're just arguing over custody, such as after you have a divorce decree or something, the number of cases with at least one party unrepresented is 83%. Now, the trouble with unrepresented litigants are they're very, very time-consuming for the court system. The Chief Justice mentioned some of this in his speech to all of you yesterday in his State of the Judiciary address. They tend not to focus necessarily on the legal issues that the court has to decide. They're very emotional cases. They're very wrapped up in their cases, but they don't have the legal judgment to know what to argue about and what not to argue about. There's a significant amount of delay stemming from them not coming to court prepared, not having the right materials ready that they need for the judge to move forward, and frequent motion practice. Now, it's hard to quantify, you know, poor presentations, and it's hard to quantify just many aspects of their poor case presentation. But one thing we do track now with our new computer system is motions. And motion practice in unrepresented litigant cases is significant. For example, since 2007, we have seen about a 21.5% increase in our family law cases, but we've seen a 34% increase in motions in those cases. In the first half of FY11, this trend continues. We have about a 5.5% additional increase in filings, but another 23% increase in motion practice. And almost all of this is post-decree motions for child custody with unrepresented litigants. However, even though unrepresented litigants represent a significant work increase for the court system, those cases are just as important to the court and certainly just as important to litigants as those who show up with an attorney. Our court system is dedicated to making sure our court's accessible to as many people as possible, not just people with attorneys. Not every court has taken this approach. Some courts have left as many barriers to pro se litigants as possible in place so that they don't show up. But But we have a system in our country where the only way you can get divorced is to go to court. And the only way you can get a child custody order is to go to court. And our court tries to be as accessible as possible to these people. But and their cases are important. And like I say, they represent a majority of the cases that court now sees in family law cases. So we're dedicated to trying to make it work, try to make a system work for them. However, we recognize that adding new judges is the most expensive way to handle caseload problems. Yesterday in his State of the Judiciary address, Chief Justice Carpinetti talked about several of our current projects that we have in the court system to better handle family law cases with unrepresented litigants. He talked about putting on, we have an instructional videos that show people, in addition to an extensive amount of forms and instructions, we have videos that are going on YouTube to help people learn how to present a case, how to be prepared for a case, how to answer questions, how to ask questions in court. He noted too, we have volunteer attorneys now that help settle cases. This new program in Anchorage, he mentioned a remarkable success rate of 70% settlement in these cases with the volunteer attorneys. We have a child custody and visitation mediation program that's also been very popular and very successful. And we use retired judges to also help settle cases by particularly informing the litigants, kind of giving them a reality check about just how strong their case is and what a court is likely to do with it. The court system is using these efforts, and there are others as well, to better manage these cases. And by better management, we see two goals of better management. One is it better serves the litigants with a process that's more appropriate for their case, and it's a more efficient use of judicial resources because it involves less work by Superior Court judges over cases that could be better handled in another manner. Now, in Anchorage, we're asking for two new Superior Court judges, but they really could use three. In fact, the Anchorage Court asked the Supreme Court to ask all of you for three judges. They would still have the highest caseloads in the state, even with three. But the Supreme Court's desire is to make up the difference between the two that they want, the two that we're asking for, and the three that they need through these better management techniques. It's our hope that we can develop these programs and further grow them to not only make up that difference, but to also limit the number of times we come before you asking for new judges for Anchorage. Today, though, we need two new judges. Even with the reforms we've implemented, we still have an incredibly busy court in Anchorage. Between the high caseloads and the extra work associated with these types of cases, the workload in Anchorage is just unsustainable. So we're asking for two judges.
Well, I just want to note, since we don't have, we're not televised statewide, we've got two numeric changes in one paragraph bill. And these short bills, seems like the shorter the bill is, the longer the next explanation is.
I'll keep that in mind next time, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The numbers you give us on case filings reflect fiscal year 2010. Do you have a three-year average of case files? So we get a better, and when was the last time that Anchorage received a new judge?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, Anchorage received new judges in 2006, and prior to that, one new judge in 2001. And I can update the FY 2010, perhaps through the first half of FY 11.
But my question is, do we have a three-year average on case files? So we, because this just gives us a snapshot of one year. What are the average cases filed for the last 3 years for all of these judges?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can easily get that for you.
Get back to the committee on the caseload. And also last year, I think it was Senate Bill 246 at the committee asking for one Superior Court judge for Anchorage. And I'm just curious, There's a change. You were mentioning that there was a request for three, but in the bill here, the technical request here is for two. Why wasn't there two asked for last year versus just the one?
Mr. Chairman, last year the Superior Court in Anchorage also asked the Supreme Court for three, and the Supreme Court decided to ask for just one and to try to make it up with these other improvements. But since that time, the caseload in Anchorage has increased by another 662 cases, and this time the court was convinced that the higher caseload justified a request for two judges.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Mr. Wolver, there was a lot of discussion about this in a previous committee, in the Judiciary Committee, and a number of questions were posed to you. I don't know if you've gotten back to those individual legislators, but one of the questions that was asked was about shouldn't Alaska have a family court division? And you said you would ask whether that had been considered before. Senator Pasvan noted that another reason to have divorce cases heard in district court would be that they would then have a mandatory right of appeal to Superior Court, but not to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And this recommendation for two additional judges in Anchorage is approved by the Supreme Court as a request to the legislature. Can you address both of those issues, please?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I did meet with Senator Pasvan following his queries to me about that, and I also met with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't support a specifically designated family law bench in Anchorage. We have tried that in the past. In fact, it wasn't that long ago we had two judges that did only family law cases. But there are a few problems with that model that we've seen. One, it tends to lead to judicial burnout. Other states resolve that problem by kind of having a revolving family law bench where you sit on that bench for 2 or 3 years and then another judge comes in and then another judge comes in, which seems like it works okay, except the trouble with that model is you end up, you'll handle family law cases for a period of time, become well versed in it, and then you move out. Someone else comes in who hasn't sat on the family law bench now in a number of years. Laws have changed, procedures have changed, and you have a kind of a perpetual issue of new judges coming into family law areas. The court doesn't think that's a very good model. The other option is to just create in statute a family law court so that when the judicial council goes out advertising and opening, they're saying this is going to be for a family law judge and you will only hear family law cases. The concern the court has with that model, there are a couple. One, it still can lead to judicial burnout, and two, you end up with a very, very narrow applicant pool for your judges. Right now, as a court of general jurisdiction, when the judicial council goes out for applicants, you get people from all walks of legal life applying for those positions. If you had a position only open to, for family law cases, you would tend to get the family bar applying for those cases. Many of our judges now who enjoy and do a very good job on family law cases never handled family law cases as attorneys. They came from any number of different legal practices. You end up drawing your judiciary from a very, very narrow slice of the bar. And the court also thinks that it's a lot better to have judges drawn from a wide variety of backgrounds, particularly since, as I mentioned, just because you have a family law practice doesn't mean you'll be a good family law judge, and just because you didn't have a family law practice doesn't mean that you would not make an excellent family law judge. In fact, like I mentioned, many of our judges who are very, very good at it came from a completely different background. So the court is not interested in trying the family law bench again. The idea of moving the cases to district court creates a number of problems. One, we would end up with too many Superior Court judges and not enough district court judges. There are 7,200 family law cases filed in Anchorage last year, and there isn't any way that our current Anchorage District Court could absorb those cases without a significant increase in the number of judges that we have there. Plus, the district court is a high volume, it's a high volume business with a fairly short period of time spent on each case. They have things like they'll have arraignments with 100 people in the morning and change of pleas with 50 defendants in the afternoon in criminal cases. They go through small claims cases very, very quickly. Family law cases, as you're probably aware, can last for years. They're very complex, they're very emotional, and they simply don't work in the district court calendar. It would allow the appeals to go to the Superior Court rather than the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court is not asking for additional, you know, help to handle the appeals of family law cases. They do make up a lot of the work the Supreme Court does. But the Supreme Court is able to handle that right now. Putting the district court in charge of family law cases would not only lead to a lot more district court judges, but it just does not fit in that, you know, in the rest of the calendaring system for district court cases. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Here we're going to go to Senator McGuire and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, through the chair, and thank you very much, Doug, for your comment on that. Just a couple comments on that, and then one more about another subject that came up in judiciary, just to put on the record and for members' edification here. On the subject of Superior Court judges in South Central, to follow up, we talked, Hollis French and I, yesterday, Senator French and I, with Judge Justice Christian, Morgan mm-hmm. Christian. We had an opportunity to discuss this issue with her, and she has agreed to meet with us in the interim mm-hmm. to form kind of a subcommittee of lawmakers and the justice and staff to look at this issue more broadly about what can be done. I agree that moving it to the district court is not the right answer, because I think people want the opportunity to have that appeal to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And there are many precedent-setting cases that end up at the Supreme Court level that deserve to be there. Secondly, I do agree with burnout, and I think that when you think of a population of 700,000 people, and of that, how many of them are qualified with Juris Doctorates and go on to be judges, you're facing a narrow pool, and you don't want to burn people out. That said, she agreed, having a background in family law, that the system isn't working perfectly. Not just perfectly, it's not working very well. Because what ends up happening is that you do get situations where you've got folks who end up as superior judges, Superior Court judges, who might have a background completely civil, let's say in contracts, large contracts, have never dealt with a family law case whatsoever, and they face it on the bench. They're highly emotional, division of custody, division of assets, and frankly are ill-equipped. It takes up a lot of time and a lot of energy. So one of the things that I mentioned was the Oregon model, the mediation model that they have, which is a precursor to court. And what it does is it's a filter that families go through, if you will, to try and weed out some of the emotion before you get through the courthouse door, so that the judge doesn't face that emotion on our clock, if you will, highly qualified Superior Court judge dealing with that stuff first. That there's sort of a liaison and a mediator that steps in at the outset to say, well, what can we sort out first, and then what really does need to be dealt with at the judicial level? She liked that idea. So I think there's more work to continue, and I just wanted to let you know about that conversation in the committee, to know that there is more work to be done, because it is taking up a lot of our Superior Court time and energy, and I think it is a concern. Secondly, women on the bench, and I want to bring that up, and I don't want to be the bra-burning feminist here at the table. I promised I wouldn't be. However, I do think it's important to note that we will now be down to one Superior Court judge in South Central, just one. And when you think about, in particular, cases where you are involving divorce and custody issues, it's been brought to my attention by women in my district and in the community. What happens in those cases, you're entitled to one bump if you will. A bump is an allowance that you don't have to justify. You know this, Senator Olson. Within 7 days, it says for no reason whatsoever, you can bump the judge. If you are representing a male client, for example, and you believe that a woman might be more biased in favor of the female, you're going to bump that female judge, and you don't have to explain why. So what you do is you end up arbitrarily putting women in the state of Alaska and South Central in a position where they may have never been in a court in their life for any other reason, and now they're facing the prospect of custody of their children and a divorce after many years. We don't know the circumstances, but they don't have an opportunity to even consider having a female, and I think that that's wrong. So what can we do to recruit more women in the bench? I asked the question in the Judiciary Committee. Interestingly enough, I got a report back within a day, and what it shows is that the Judicial Council itself has put forward many female names to the heads of state, to the governors over the past 20 years. So in fact, they have done the job of putting those names forward. It has been the head of state in all cases that has picked the males over the females. So that's where the problem lies. That said, and when I talked to Justice Carpinetti about the issue yesterday, he said that there are gender differences with respect to how women handle those situations, and that he's had private conversations with the women who end up rejected in that process. And for those of you that don't know about it, you put your name forward, you have to be voted on by your colleagues. They give you a rating out of 1 out of 5. So you come back with, let's say, a 4.2. You're rated by your judges, by your colleagues themselves. It's like a grading system, basically. You might be 47 years old and been practicing for years. Then you go through that process of having your name submitted in front of the entire public. And once rejected, many of the women say, I'm not putting my name in again. I don't want to go through that. In fact, he doesn't know of a single woman who's put their name in twice. So that's an issue. Whatever it is, we need to work on it. And he expressed agreement on that. At the legislative level, I would like to express on the record that as a state, much like we do in a representative form of government in this branch, we need to have more women on the bench. Our young women that are in school right now are looking to role models. They want to be judges someday, some of them. They want to be police officers, some of them. They want to be legislators. And they need to know that they have access to justice from both sides, both genders. And so whatever we can do to encourage more women on the bench, we want to do that. And I just want to put that on the record here today.
We'll go to Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Egan, and then Senator Thomas.
I'd just like to get some information from you, Doug, on, and you could provide it later, on the caseloads for district court judges.
I, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'll get you those.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, in fiscal note number one, you're requesting about $425,000 for remodeling. Yet the judges and staff start at the beginning of the fiscal year. So where are these judges and staff going to be housed while you're doing this $425,000 in remodeling, or are you going to get it done by July 1?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, the selection process takes a while for judges. So once this, if this bill does pass the legislature, then the Judicial Council starts its process for selecting judges, which takes several months. And by the time those judges are seated, the remodels are scheduled to be finished.
So this fiscal note would be less then, correct? Because you wouldn't be hiring these new judges and staff on July 1.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we won't be hiring the judges, but what we will be doing is using pro tem judges, you know, retired Superior Court judges to fill in, which is what we're currently doing right now. I think Mr. Christensen in our budget presentations and conversations with you have mentioned that a lot of the pro tem time we've had budgeted, we've spent in this past year, isn't in our budget. And we will be continuing to use those judges up until the time we have the new judges seated.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug, can you tell me what is the percentage of cases that are filed that are ultimately contested? There is something contested, so that they then go from the standing master specialist to a judge.
Through the chair, Senator, I can find that information out for you.
Okay.
Do you have any other questions? We've got no one has called in. We've got a few people online to answer questions, but we don't have any questions for them. Let me read through the list of fiscal notes, and it is quite lengthy, such a small bill. There are eight fiscal notes in your packet. One note from the court system showing an appropriation in the amount of $1,440,800 in general funds, $1,015,600 of that is needed to pay for the two new judges and their support staff. $425,200 is requested for the Nesbitt Courthouse remodel. There's currently $4 million in the FY12 capital budget for the Anchorage Court renovation, which includes the funds needed for the Anchorage Courthouse remodel. There's a one note from the Alaska Judicial Council for $23,200 in general funds to cover the cost of investigating, interviewing, and nominating candidates for the governor. There's one note from the Department of Administration's Public Defender's Agencies in the amount of $232,400 in general funds to pay for the additional attorney and attorney assistant. Another note from the Department of the Administration in the amount of $232,400 in general funds to hire an additional attorney and attorney assistants in the Office of Public Advocacy. One note from the Department of Public Safety for $135,400 in general funds to hire an additional court service officer. One note from the Department of Corrections in the amount of $111,400 in general funds to hire one new full-time adult probation officer. That note will be zeroed out and is being pulled by the request of the department. One note from the Department of Law for $225,000 in general funds to hire one new attorney and a part-time attorney's assistant in the Anchorage Child Protection Section. Finally, there's a zero fiscal note from the Division of Elections. Total cost by the court system and the administration is $2,400,600 in general funds for a total of 16 new positions. So dealing with the Department of Corrections, why do we need an additional probation officer for the civil court cases? And is there anybody that wants to speak to that from the, I guess we'll take the Department of Corrections, excuse me, we pulled that one. We'll go to the Department of Public Safety. Why do we need additional court service officers for non-criminal court? And maybe Lieutenant Dial, can you help us with that, please?
Is he on? Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Lieutenant Dial with the Troopers, stationed out of Ketchikan. The department has no concerns with this legislation. However, additional judges, even civil court judges, will generate more work for our Judicial Services Unit in Anchorage. That work generally includes times where officers will be assigned to hearings for security reasons and to process and serve the civil paperwork and subpoenas generated by the new judges. Our Judicial Services Unit in Anchorage is currently at maximum capacity with the current system. So to adequately handle and make sure that we have the resources to provide for the needs of the court, we're requesting one new court service officer.
Okay. And then on the Department of Administration, dealing with caseloads, it's been requested that we take a look at the caseloads over the last 3 years and look at that. And we can look at the existing public defenders and the public advocacy attorneys, try to get a handle on child in need of aid cases in the Department of Administration, but I don't see anybody here. Maybe we'll have a brief Eddie. On the record, we'll go to Quinlan Steiner, please. If you're online, could you help us with that last question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. The fiscal note is in there to add a position and a support staff position in Anchorage, though The Anchorage caseload has remained somewhat stable. This additional, the additional positions will accelerate the workload for our civil division. It's anticipated that that will require more work and more court hearings. There is a push for more status hearings, and these additional judges are likely to put pressure on our attorneys to be at those hearings and be prepared. Additionally, though our civil division in Anchorage is specialized, the rest of the state generally is not. They carry mixed caseloads in some of the smaller offices, and the smaller office caseloads for child in need of aid cases are increasing, and we use our Anchorage unit, which specializes to provide assistance in both case oversight and training, and so those additional pressures are placed on Anchorage. Additionally, we're short on support staff generally, and so that additional attorney will need support to operate effectively and efficiently.
Okay. And then on last year, on that Senate Bill 246, we had a zero fiscal note. And then this year we've got a positive fiscal note, so maybe you could help us with that issue.
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember exactly the fiscal note. In fact, I didn't look it up. I'd have been surprised if I'd assessed it as zero if they were going to add somebody to do civil cases. Because of the fact that right now we have only six attorneys in Anchorage handling the civil calendar, but 10 judges scheduling cases. So we actually daily have issues of placing attorneys before judges. But I'd be happy to go back and look and see what I did and look at the justification. I just don't recall.
We'll clarify that. And I think Mr. Wolliver will help us with the changes and requests from last year, this year. And it always seems at this table whenever there's a request from one agency, if any other agencies can jump on with additional additive employees, there always seems to be a list of that. So I think the committee here will take a pretty hard look at the fiscal notes and try to zero them out as a general rule as we move forward as much as possible. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious about whether or not I don't handle any of these budgets, but whether or not any of these overarching fiscal concerns are addressed in the governor's operating budget with respect to OPA, with respect to facilities, all the things that are cropping up in the fiscal notes.
We'll have to go in and take a look at that as we go through the operating budget. I'd be surprised. But I would note that this committee the last several years has been very supportive of the court system and their desire to expand the fiscal situations that they're in, physical, in the capital budget to try to get the courthouse remodels done, and we haven't been supported by the other branch of government, and it takes three of us to move this forward. And I noticed in the capital budget this year there's $4 million or some number added here a minute ago. $4 million in Anchorage campus court renovations, and I haven't had time to take a look at that to see if that is in fact one of the items that we had already had in our budget before that was removed. We'll have to have those discussions with the administration as far as what's going on and why they're coming forward with this request today when we had it. I'd be surprised if this wasn't a request that wasn't in over the last couple of years. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And if I could just follow up, I mean, I think, you know, we're dealing with the fact that we need the Superior Court, but there's the lead up to it. So there's the Office of Public Advocacy, the fact that you've got child in need of aid issues that are increasing two and threefold in some communities. There's the fact that you don't have support in the Public Defender Agency. All those things can be addressed at the administrative and operating level. And I'm just curious how they all fold in together. And then my second question is, in Ketchikan, just doing the ratios of number of cases filed to number of judges, Mr. Chairman, in your district, it looks to me like you might be in need of at least a half a judge or one more judge, because you've got 632 cases to two. So just a thought.
Right, and those numbers may change somewhat as we go forward and look over the next, you know, we'll do a three-year look back. But when you do your numeric columns, maybe throw a percentage column in here so it'll speed things up. Otherwise, we sit here with our calculators.
A percentage change, Mr. Chairman, is that?
Yeah, the ratios. Take your 632 and divide it by 2 in Ketchikan's. Take 10,298 and divide it by 15. Cases filed or cases per judge, however you want to.
They did.
Yeah, cases per judge.
Excuse me, cases per judge.
Oh, there you go. I see on the other side. And I guess, if I might, Mr. Chairman, do you have the ability to have judges that rotate between communities?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, yes, and they do that extensively all over Alaska, both because of peremptory challenges and because of workloads. The judges here in Southeast travel, all the judges travel quite a bit in Southeast. In the Second Judicial District, there is a lot, especially with those, you know, Barrow, Kotzebue, and Nome, each having one judge. Those judges circulate between those communities routinely.
Any other questions for the Mr. Wooliver? We discussed these two numeric changes in one paragraph very well today. That always leads to a lot of discussion on small bills. But that'll conclude today's meeting. And then when you get back to the back to my office on that, those answers, then we'll just disseminate them amongst the committee members and go from there. Tomorrow we'll not have a meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday the 14th, 9 a.m. We'll hear from agencies on the FY12 capital budget, and we'll start that process. Unless we have any additional comments or concerns, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr.